Hello, my friends. Welcome back. Dr. Ken Berry here. I've got a special guest with me today who recently wrote a book that you need to know about. This guy is board certified in general surgery and cardiothoracic surgery. So he is a heart surgeon, not just a cardiologist. I know many cardiologists would take offense at what I just said. But this is the guy that fixed the plumbing when you've messed it up with your diet. And I think you're going to be a little bit shocked and perhaps even amazed by what he has to say about a low-carb diet, keto diet, carnivore diet, a cardiothoracic surgeon, board-certified, Tufts-trained, Dr. Philip Ovadia. Let's bring this guy on, and I want him to tell you what he thinks about a proper human diet. Dr. Ovadia.
Hey, Ken. Great to be here with you.
Welcome. Welcome. So glad to have you here. Take a little time out of your busy schedule. I know surgeons aren't busy at all. I mean, you guys just goof around, right? But so many people are worried about the heart ramifications of eating a diet that's full of saturated fat, full of fatty meat, full of egg yolks, full of fatty seafood. And so I wanted to take this opportunity to chat with you. You're basically you're the guy who gets us at the end when we've really screwed up the vascular tree. You're the guy who tries to fix it. And so start off, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, how you kind of came talking about this, and then writing a book about it that was released recently.
Sure thing. So, you know, I have been a practicing heart surgeon now for 15 years and, you know, graduated medical school almost 25 years ago now with all the training and everything. And, you know, so I've performed over 3,000 heart surgeries, and obviously I'm intimately familiar with heart disease, the number one killer in the United States and worldwide. And the backstory is during much of that time, I was becoming progressively unhealthy myself. I had battled obesity my entire life. And I had gotten to a point, you know, this is about 7 years ago now, where I was morbidly obese. I was pre-diabetic, and I realized that I was going to end up on my own operating table. But I was really at a loss to do, a loss about what to do, because I was doing everything I had learned in school and all the advice I was giving my patients, you know, eat the low-fat diet, count your calories, eat according to the food pyramid, and it was failing me. And it was failing my patients. And thankfully, I came across, you know, some alternative information. My journey really started, as so many of our journeys have, with Gary Taubes. And fortuitously, he was a guest speaker at one of the thoracic surgical meetings that I was attending. And he had just written a case against sugar. And of course, prior to that, you know, good calories, bad calories, and why we get fat. I immediately started, you know, eliminating sugar and carbohydrates and processed food. And ultimately, I was able to help myself. I lost over 100 pounds. I reversed my prediabetes. And more importantly, what I came to realize was how we were failing the patients that I was taking care of every day. How almost every patient that ended up on my operating room table was a failure of the medical system. And, you know, this narrative that had been built around, you know, cholesterol, and the only way to prevent heart disease is by lowering your cholesterol, you know, as we're going to get into, is just simply not true. And, you know, the real ways that we can start to prevent heart disease comes down to, you know, eating better foods, eating whole real foods primarily. And that's what spurred me to write the book and really has spurred my whole other mission in life, which is to keep people off of my operating room table. And of course, that's going to sound real strange coming from a surgeon, because most surgeons are out there looking for how they can be, you know, busier. But the reality is that I am way too busy as a heart surgeon, and I would much rather people stay off my operating table.
No, I applaud that message that you're putting out there as a surgeon who gets paid for doing surgery. And I keep hearing this over and over in the low-carb, keto, carnivore community from healthcare providers. It's like, well, even though this is going to directly impact my income, And I think the first time I ever heard this was from Gary Fetke, who's an orthopedic surgeon who just told people, you got to stop the sugar. I don't want to have to chop your leg off. And he got in trouble with his hospital. But I keep hearing this from dietitians in the low carb space, even though I risk being slapped on the wrist by my medical board or by the hospital committee, even though I run risk of actually lowering my income as a surgeon, I still have an ethical duty. Once I found this out, once it worked for me, once it worked for usually a small sample size of patients, so you're like, you know, just try this and see what happens. Once it worked for them and you started delving into the science, did you feel ethically compelled to start recommending a low carb diet to your patients?
Yes. Ultimately, I hope that all of, each one of us as physicians went into this because we want to help people first and foremost. And that should be our primary concern, the patient and how we can best help the patient. And, you know, I realized pretty quickly that the way that I could be best helping my patients is by teaching them this information to help them improve their lives and help them, you know, not end up needing heart surgery, or even if they did need the heart surgery, to still improve their lives afterwards. The bottom line is that it's never too late to start making these changes. And even if you have advanced heart disease, I have seen patients dramatically improve their quality of life by instituting, you know, these dietary changes. And I have seen them lower their risk of, you know, ongoing problems related to the heart disease, the diabetes, the high blood pressure, all of these things that we know are treatable by diabetes. So, you know, I think many, you know, there are many of us in this community that repeat, you know, you can't unsee it once you see it. And that's simply the truth for me. And, you know, I realized pretty quickly that this wasn't something that I could just keep to myself. Fortunately, I'm in a position where, you know, I'm able to, write the book and have the audience to get this information out to people. And like many of us, I am also finding different ways to work with patients so that I'm not waiting for them to come to me as a heart surgeon. I also have a telemedicine practice where I work with people who are trying to prevent heart disease or improve their heart disease if they already have it.
Absolutely. And I've got a picture hooked up. Dr. Philip Avadia is a cardiothoracic surgeon, a heart surgeon, and he wrote a book, Stay Off My Operating Table. I think this is available at all bookstores. There is an Audible version for all you guys with ADHD like me. You can listen to it while you do three other things. It's an excellent read. I think you can tell by the foods shown on the front of the cover that Dr. Avadia, a heart surgeon, is not afraid of red meat or even processed meat. Doc, somebody just in the comments, they said, my heart doctor is a vegan and recommends that I eat only a plant-based diet. Now, I know that you've delved into the research about how food affects heart function and cardiovascular health. How are you and I able to look at the same research that all the vegan and plant-based cardiologists and cardiothoracic surgeons, they look at the same research we do, but yet somehow you and I come to a drastically different conclusion as to what the research means or it very often does not mean? Can you explain that for the viewers? You're a heart guy. How can you not be recommending a vegan diet?
Yeah. So, you know, what was interesting to me as I, you know, thought about all the different diets that people have used and, you know, we look at the literature as to, you know, what seems to help with heart disease and the commonality that I was able to find. And that was sort of my approach to it. You know, what do these things have in common? What do the vegan diet and the carnivore diet have in common? And what they have in common is that they are whole, real food. They have eliminated processed food. Although, you know, of course, we all know that Oreos are technically vegan. So there are bad ways to do a vegan diet, just as there are bad ways to do every diet. But the people who are successful with all of these different dietary strategies, the vegan diet, the carnivore diet, keto, Atkins, Mediterranean, paleo, what they have in common is the more that you eliminate processed food, the more you focus on eating whole, real food, that is what leads to the success. That is what leads to the positive health outcomes that we're looking for.
Oh, I totally agree. I think that my standard advice for somebody who's like, I'm brand new to this, I don't know anything about anything, what's the first three steps? Remove all sugars, definitely processed sugar, also much of the naturally occurring sugar. Number two, remove all the grains, beans and legumes. Number three, remove all the vegetable seed oil. And you may or may not agree with those first three steps, but the reason I think those steps help so many people is that that essentially eliminates all the highly processed food. With some added salt and maybe some flavors and other things, but the main three ingredients are sugar, grains, beans, legumes, and vegetable seed oils. So do you think all three of those, do you look at all three of those categories as the villains that I do, or do you think, I don't know about the grains or the vegetable seed oils? What's your take on that?
Yeah, so the vegetable and the seed oils and the highly processed carbohydrates are clearly things that were never meant for human consumption. And, you know, it's always interesting when people talk about, you know, the carnivore diet and they say, oh, it's a fad. And, you know, the answer is no. The processed food-based, you know, standard American diet is the fad. Carnivore diets and, you know, eating plant material are things that we have been doing as humans for millions of years. It's only within the blink of an eye, you know, on the grand scale of things, that we have introduced these processed foods into our environment. And the two main components are, you know, fake fats, these vegetable and seed oils, and highly processed carbohydrates, including sugar. You know, which one of those two is doing the damage? I would say not clear. The combination is certainly horrible for us. And, you know, honestly, there's no reason that we need to be eating either one. Neither one is essential to the human diet. So my answer is just cut it all out, cut out the processed food. And then, you know, how much meat, how much veg, you know, you want. That, I think, comes down to some individual preferences and some, you know, situation. You know, it depends on the person. Largely, and I've seen people who have had success doing both strategies, but simple rule, just eat whole real food.
Yeah, and actually it turns out that sugars and grains and vegetable seed oils are essential to the profits of big food manufacturers.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, and but if what you'd like to, the listener, what you'd like to focus on is optimizing your own good health, then sugars and grains and vegetable seed oils play no meaningful part in that whatsoever. You need to eat real, one ingredient, whole food, ancestrally appropriate, nutrient dense, ancestrally appropriate foods. And Doc, part of my going down this rabbit hole is I started really reading deeply in the anthropology literature and the paleoanthropology literature. And when I started going down that route, it became very clear very quickly that it's well known in the paleoanthropological community that human beings have been super carnivores for over 2 million years. The definition of super carnivores, at least 70% of our food by volume came from animal products. And so, again, we come back to the modern research that many cardiologists and cardiothoracic surgeons love to quote and cite and say, look, if you eat red meat, that's going to give you heart disease. What are they getting wrong, Doc? What are the cardiologists that you and I are kind of having a stern conversation with every day on our Twitter accounts? How are these heart doctors getting it wrong when it comes to modern nutrition research versus what's well known in the paleoanthropological literature?
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, they have fallen prey to the healthcare system and the direction that the healthcare system has gone in. And, you know, of course, you and I, and I'm sure many people in the audience are familiar with that this whole concept started in the 1950s with Ansel Keys and his misguided theory that, you know, consuming saturated fat was the cause of heart disease. And, you know, many people have gone into all the flaws in that theory. But, you know, the result of that is that people said, you know, meat, red meat in particular, contains saturated fat. And so therefore it must be bad to eat. Now, the interesting thing is that red meat doesn't actually contain all that much saturated fat. It's only, you know, 40, 50%, depending on what cuts and, you know, what source you're looking at. It has always, you know, been a sort of conundrum that I can't get an answer from all the plant-based doctors, is that coconut oil is always put forth as being a healthy oil to consume, yet it has the highest percentage of saturated fat of any commonly consumed, you know, food product. It's like 95% saturated fat. And yet, you know, coconut oil is healthy and meat with its 40 to 50% saturated fat is put forth as unhealthy.
Yep, I totally agree. And you quickly start hearing the crickets chirp when you start talking about, you know, coconut oil, that's a plant-based oil. How is it bad? Because it's higher in saturated fat than the fattiest cut of fatty beef brisket you can find. It's got more saturated fat. Now, the next thing I want to know is, I want to know, we've got almost 3,000 people watching. I want to know where all you guys are watching from. What city, what state, what country, where are you at in the world right now? Tell us in the comments. I want Dr. Ovadia to see where all you guys are watching from today and joining us. Now, Doc, let's talk about blood pressure. Somebody asked, they said, my BP is 157 over 90. Is that high? And so, yes, I think you and I both would agree that's high. If that's their average, they need to be doing something about that. Do you subscribe to the American Heart Association's new lower blood pressure guidelines? Or do you, like me, the American Academy of Family Physicians opted not to go with the AHA's new lower blood pressure guidelines, which would essentially mean that 2/3 of the adult population of America would need to be on a blood pressure lowering medication. What do you consider, as a physician, what's your cutoff for, oh, that's too high, you need a blood pressure pill?
Yeah, so I, you know, default to the sort of well-accepted definitions of metabolic health and blood pressure less than 130 over 85. Without the use of medications is what's defined as metabolically healthy. When you look at the data around blood pressure, you know, it's really around 140-ish that you start to see worsened health outcomes, specifically looking at heart disease and stroke. And there really isn't any evidence that going lower than that is better. You know, the paradigm from the American Heart Association around heart disease suffers from the same problem as their paradigm around cholesterol management. And, you know, they came out with these guidelines and they said, we need to lower your cholesterol to this and your blood pressure to this. And yet heart disease has remained the number one killer. And really, you know, we've been unable to make a significant dent in heart disease statistics outside of smoking cessation. And so the American Heart Association being so bought into the narrative around cholesterol and, you know, around pharmaceutical treatment of blood pressure says, well, we just must not be doing it strong enough. We must not be doing it well enough. So let's make the limits even lower because, you know, everyone knows if, you know, low is good, then lower must be better. But we really don't have any science to support that.
I like what you said right there, doctor. I want to dig into that. So the American Heart Association, I think currently it's 120 over 70,
something, yeah,
obscenely low, that the average person over the age of 65 or 70, they're going to get hypotensive. They're going to get lightheaded. They're going to have episodes of syncope. They're going to fall and hit their head if you pharmaceutically lower their blood pressure that low, especially if they've been running 140 over 85 for years and years and years. That's not a normal blood pressure for them. Do you think the American Heart Association, let's get a little conspiratorial here, perhaps, Do you think that the American Heart Association based their new guidelines on some science that I can't find and maybe you can't find either? Or do you think there might be a little bit of credence to the semi-conspiratorial belief that the American Heart Association is kind of in bed with Big Pharma and they kind of made this artificially low blood pressure the new goal, just for blood pressure pills? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is not conspiratorial to say that the American Heart Association is in bed with Big Pharma. You know, we know their funding sources. We see that, you know, you go to the conferences and you just see the endless, you know, advertisements for pharmaceutical products at you know, their conferences every year. So I don't think it's conspiratorial to say. Furthermore, we look at the people who sit on the guideline committees and we see all of the disclosures about all their ties to the industry. So, you know, whether or not that's their primary motivation, you know, I'm not going to go quite that far to say that it's their primary motivation, but it certainly has an influence on their thinking. And more so what I see, like I said, is that they had this theory and, you know, it really started with the cholesterol part of it. And they said, okay, lowering people's cholesterol is going to take care of heart disease. We're going to wipe out heart disease by lowering their cholesterol. And it didn't work. And their only answer was, we must need to lower cholesterol better instead of stepping back. And I admit this takes a lot to admit you were wrong and say, you know, maybe we were wrong about the cholesterol thing to start with. And of course, you know, as you go into in your great book, as I talk about all the time, you know, it takes a lot for physicians and it takes a lot for the medical community, the healthcare industry to admit they made a mistake. And unfortunately, the American Heart Association just doesn't seem willing to do that to any degree and start to step back some of these recommendations, which simply aren't working.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I'm sure you're aware now that both the American Diabetes Association and the American Heart Association now accept as an acceptable therapeutic intervention a low carbohydrate or a very low carbohydrate diet for patients with type 2 diabetes. That's in both of their guidelines now. The AHA basically adopted the ADA's guidelines when it comes to people with type 2 diabetes and heart disease. They now say that a low carbohydrate diet is one of the therapeutic dietary interventions that is acceptable. Now, there's tons of doctors, physicians, assistants, and nurse practitioners out there who take care of patients every single day, and they're not aware. They don't know because they didn't, you know, really the ADA and the AHA should hold a joint press conference on all major and say, hey, we really screwed up the diabetes recommendations. Every type 2 diabetic needs to eat a diet 100% across the board. But they're never going to do that. And so they bury it on page 192 of a 250-page document. No healthcare provider, if they've got a full book, they don't have time to read that whole thing. So they're still unaware that it's now acceptable medical practice to recommend a low-carbohydrate diet to patients with type 2 diabetes, either with or without heart disease. And the other thing that the American Heart Association, they keep trying to lower and get lower and lower and lower is the LDL cholesterol number. Your career has the goal LDL cholesterol number been lower? And then let's talk about the panel. What numbers do you think are truly important? Which ones do you kind of care less about, et cetera?
Yeah. So, you know, I graduated medical school in 1998, statins by that time had become the most widely prescribed class of medication in the world. And the guidelines at that time, as I remember them, were at LDL cholesterol less than 140. Total cholesterol, I think, was less than 220, I want to say, or maybe even 240. And gradually over time, they've been lowered and lowered. And today, the official guidelines say that, you know, you should have an LDL cholesterol of less than 100. And of course, now we have these, you know, newer medications, the PCSK9 inhibitors, that we are literally driving patients' LDL cholesterol down to 20 or 30. you know, unheard of levels. You know, we look at the correlation between LDL cholesterol and heart disease, and it's a lousy correlation. So in the end, you know, what I say about LDL cholesterol is it's a useless marker. We shouldn't even be paying attention to it anymore. We have much better metrics. And, you know, you look at the, you know, if you want to believe that cholesterol is a primary driver of heart disease, you know, you can at least look at, you know, the European guidelines, the Canadian guidelines. They've all moved beyond LDL cholesterol, and they talk about ApoB, and they talk about, you know, NMR and size, you know, particle distribution. And then we can look at other markers like Lp little a. And so, you know, what I end up doing with a lot of the patients that I interact with now is just saying, let's get beyond the LDL, you know, because if you go to your doctor and they are making a treatment decision based on one number, they are not doing their job as a doctor. That is the bottom line. We need to be looking at a more complete picture of our patients. And, you know, it just, the guidelines only have the one number in them. But of course, as you said, you know, most doctors don't even know the guidelines. They don't know that the CAC score is in there in the guidelines. So the CAC score is underutilized. When things like, you know, when messages get changed, like saturated fat is no longer a nutrient of concern, also buried on page 100, whatever. And those things, you know, physicians don't see. And of course, the American Heart Association and the, you know, ADA, like you said, are not going out of their way to, you know, push this information out to the doctors.
Yeah, it's really concerning. And so do you think that the triglyceride HDL ratio, do you think that plays a special role, that ratio? Or are you happy to see somebody with a normal triglyceride level under 150 and an HDL above 40 or 50, depending on their gender? Or do you think the ratio plays a significant special role?
Well, I think the ratio is important in as much as it reflects, it's an indirect reflection of your insulin sensitivity. And, you know, your insulin sensitivity is really the most powerful blood marker of your heart disease risk. But of course, most doctors don't measure insulin resistance or insulin sensitivity. So we have to, you know, use this indirect measure of it, which is the triglyceride to HDL ratio, to try and, you know, help patients predict whether or not they are insulin sensitive. So I do pay a lot of attention to the ratio. You know, for the patients that I work with, I recommend a triglyceride level less than 100, and I want to see your HDL greater than 50, which gets you to a ratio of less than 2, which has been correlated with being insulin sensitive. But of course, I also, you know, do the insulin sensitivity measurements, and that's the real information that we want to know.
I totally agree.
Consistently, study after study, every study that has looked at the two, insulin resistance in some way and LDL cholesterol, insulin resistance is always a much more powerful predictor of your heart disease risk.
Yeah, I really think that if any of you guys listening to this, all 3,700 of you, if you go to your doctor and you get lab work drawn, and the doctor, the number one thing your doctor wants to talk about is your LDL cholesterol. They don't want to talk about your A1C, even if it's high. They don't want to, definitely, they didn't even check your fasting insulin or your C-peptide, which is an excellent proxy marker for hyperinsulinemia. They don't want to talk about your triglyceride to HDL ratio. They just want to talk about the damn LDL. I would opine, Dr. Ovadia, cardiothoracic surgeon, that they basically are de facto employees of big pharma corporations. They have forgotten the basic human physiology and pathophys of what leads to inflammation and damage to the intima of the cardiac arteries and indeed arteries all over the body. Why are doctors so compelled to only want to focus on the LDL to the point where they become emotional and get upset and angry at a patient if the patient even says, well, look, I've lowered my A1C from 8 down to 5.2. Isn't that somehow protective, even if my LDL cholesterol is high? What's going on with these doctors?
Yeah, so I think it really comes down to that, you know, the doctors had abdicated their responsibility to the patient. And, you know, they are trapped in a healthcare system where they are overwhelmed. They are so busy taking care of sick people that they literally just don't have the time to think for themselves anymore. So their only choice is to, you know, just follow the guidelines. And the real challenge becomes, you know, when someone challenges those deeply held beliefs, you know, and I admit, you know, I believed, I knew that cholesterol was the cause of heart disease for the first, you know, 10 plus years as my, in my career as a heart surgeon.
Yep.
And then I started to see the other information and, you know, it takes a lot, you know, it takes, without being sounding sexist, you know, you have to be a man to admit you were wrong. And you have to own up to that mistake and you have to, you know, admit that. It is ironic because, you know, you and I both heard as we went through medical school many times, the quip that, you know, half of what you were learning in medical school is going to be proven to be wrong by the time you retire. We just don't know which half. And yet, as many times as we hear that, we don't internalize it. You know, we believe that everything we learned in school is the absolute truth, and it's going to remain the absolute truth for our, you know, career as physicians. And it just,
yeah, you know, the human nature involved in that, because it's like every physician believes that half of what every other physician learned was wrong, but everything they learned was right. And I think for a physician, when you start to stop and consider that literally half of what you consider knowledge about human physiology, human pathophys, and human outcomes is wrong. I mean, that's terrifying for someone who makes a living of being the guy or the gal that's supposed to know what they're talking about. I mean, that's just terrifying for, and many doctors can, they just cognitively, they just dissonance. They cannot handle that, holding that belief in their head. So they just block it out. Now, Cindy's got a question. She just had a CAC score. Came back, her CAC score was 5,500. Aortic valve score was 1,856. She's been keto since 9/20. What should she do? Now, everybody out there, I'm getting hundreds of questions. If you really want to get your question answered, attach it to a super chat like Cindy did. That gets it pushed to the top. You don't have to do that, but if you really need your question answered by a cardiothoracic surgeon, that's the way to do it. Of course, nothing we say today is medical advice. We are not your doctors this day, even if we are your doctor at other times in life. What would you say to Cindy?
Yeah, so in general, for people with very high CAC scores, you know, the concerns become, are you having any symptoms related to that? You know, are you getting short of breath when you exert yourself? Are you getting chest pains? And if any of those answers are true, you know, that's something that you really need to get on top of. You might need to have an angiogram or a CT angiogram, which is a more invasive type of test to really see if you have blockages in your arteries that are significant. But outside of that, if you're not having symptoms, you know, it means that you have time to figure out what's going on. And the thing about a high CAC score is it's one snapshot in time. And we know that higher CAC scores put you at higher risk for developing heart disease. But more importantly, we also know that the change in your CAC score is a powerful predictor of your risk. So if you get another scan a year later and that score continues to increase, that puts you at even higher risk. But if that score doesn't increase and, you know, maybe even if it decreases some, that then lowers your risk. And there are things that you can do to stop the progression of coronary artery calcium. And hopefully, you know, in some situations, I have seen it lower. That's controversial, but I have seen it in my patients. And these are, you know, all the principles that we talk about: eating whole real food, getting adequate sleep, managing your stress appropriately. There are some supplements that have been at least suggested to help, minimize the risk of progression of coronary calcium. Most important thing I would tell, you know, Cindy or anyone else in that situation is find a good physician who really understands heart disease and what leads to it, what worsens it, how to improve it, to work with, so that you can, you know, hopefully stop that from progressing to the point that you have clinical manifestations then of what we're seeing on the scan.
Absolutely. I love it. Now let's talk about stents. I've seen a couple of questions in the comments about are stents, or should I get a stent? And I know that that varies from case to case. I can remember just a few years ago when it was routine to use stents as primary prevention. If somebody, if they just had a cath for some vague symptom and they had a 70, 80, 90% blockage, no symptoms, they got a stent. What's the current state of the art recommendations about stents? When should they be? Did we put in hundreds of thousands of stents needlessly in patients, and it turns out they didn't really serve a therapeutic purpose?
Yeah, unfortunately we did. And, you know, this is one of the, you know, big mea culpas that I think the healthcare system owes people. The reality is that the only situation where, you know, we have good scientific data to show the benefits of stents is in someone who is having what we call an acute coronary syndrome. That means they're having active ischemia, low blood flow to an area of their heart, and they have a significant blockage in that area. That is the one situation where we know stents actually prolong life. All of these other situations, we don't have that data. And in fact, we're getting more and more data showing that they are not helpful to put stents in when we only have, you know, less significant blockages. And importantly, when patients aren't having signs of active ischemia. And you know, to be perfectly frank, there were a lot of heart surgeries done in the past that weren't necessary either, because the data around coronary artery bypass surgery, CABG surgery, the most common procedure that I perform as a heart surgeon, you know, is very much the same, that it only extends life. It's only beneficial in certain situations. And, you know, both of those modalities, similar to the pharmaceuticals we've been talking about, were greatly overused without, you know, good enough data to support that. So, you know, what I encourage people to do is ask more questions of their doctors.
100%.
You know, really ask them, you know, is this going to benefit me? How is this going to benefit me? Whether we're talking about medications, surgeries, you know, any sort of treatment, how is this going to benefit me? What are the risks associated with it? And, yep. And unless it is truly a, you know, life-threatening emergency, you know, you're having the heart attack, you have a tear in a blood vessel, an aortic dissection, you know, things like that. There should be time to have that discussion, and your doctor should be willing to have that discussion with you. Because if 100%. They're not, and their only answer is, well, I'm the doctor, I know what's best for you, you know, hopefully you can find another doctor.
Yeah. If any doctor, as a patient, all you 4,000 folks watching this, if your doctor becomes emotionally upset with you for wanting to have a discussion about your one life, your literal health, that's a huge red flag that you need to find a new doctor, at least get a second opinion. So many cardiologists paid for their Mercedes by doing unnecessary stents. And I'm not saying they all knew they were unnecessary. I'm saying that the research was so equivocal. If they had just a little bit more of an ethical sense, they'd have been like, I don't really think using stents for primary prevention, I don't think that's probably a good thing. But man, people don't understand. The patient doesn't understand that a cardiologist, if they just see somebody for an office visit, that's good money. But when you, if you take them to the cath lab and put in two or three stents, the amount of money you receive for that, and it takes the same length of time as the amount that for an extended office visit, it's a 10 times. You're making 10 times the money. And so people, they go where the money is. It's human nature. We can't help it. Dawn's got a question. She had a CABG and an aortic valve repair 2.5 years ago. I've answered this question so many times following up with heart surgery patients. Her sternum still pops and it's uncomfortable. It freaks her out. Is that normal? Is that dangerous?
So normal, no. Dangerous, also probably no, but it's uncomfortable. And certainly, you know, going back, getting reevaluated by your surgeon, it would be important in that situation. You know, your your cardiologist or your family medical doctor isn't going to be able to really deal with that problem outside of giving you pain medicine, which isn't the right answer to that problem either. So in general, in those situations, I recommend people go back, see the surgeon that did the surgery or see another surgeon, because you really shouldn't be having those types of problems a couple of years after surgery. Initially,
yeah,
after
2.5 years later, that's not normal. But yeah. I can't tell you the number of times I'd see somebody for 3 month follow up of a CABG, and they'd be like, "Doc, this is something ain't right. And every time I move or cough, it pops. I can feel it shift." I'm like, "It's fine. It's literally carpentry. They've got your sternum stuck together with baling wire. It'll grow back together in time." But it sounds like our previous questioner may need to go back and see your surgeon. Craig wants to know, what do you do after you've had stents and a heart attack? Do you recommend anything differently in that situation versus somebody just for primary prevention?
Yeah, so I really don't. You know, the advice around how to get metabolically healthy, how to, start eating whole real food and all these other habits doesn't change whether or not, you know, you've had a heart attack or whether or not you have heart disease. Because what I tell people in that situation is our goal now is to prevent you from having more problems related to the heart disease in the future. We may not be able to undo the damage that's been done. In some situations, we can undo some of the damage that's been done, but our primary goal becomes, let's make sure you don't have more problems, you don't continue to build up, blockages in your arteries. And the way to do that is the same way to prevent it in the first place. And it comes down to eating whole real food, getting, you know, activity, getting sunlight, managing your stress are the primary things.
Yep, totally agree. Response Digital Media says, is there any situation that prescribing or taking a statin makes sense?
Yeah, so the best data we have around statins is what's called secondary prevention. So these are people who already had a heart attack or some cardiovascular event, and we're trying to prevent a second one. And that is the strongest data in support of statins. And especially if, you know, I'm dealing with someone who I have the conversation and I talk to them about, you know, eating whole real food and all the things we've been talking about. And they say, "I just don't want to do that, doc." Then, yeah, it probably makes sense for you to take a statin and it's going to have a small benefit. The benefits of statins are largely overstated, and the negative effects of statins are largely understated. And that's what we have to understand around the statin decision.
Totally agree.
Again, this comes down to, this should be a very involved, this is a very nuanced discussion, whether or not you should be taking a statin. It is not as simple as your one number is this, so you should be taking this medication. And if your physician who is prescribing that statin can't go beyond, "You should just take this because this number is high," find another physician who will have that conversation with you and make the decision if in your case it makes sense for you to take the statin or not.
Yep, totally agree. Ashley's uncle used to be a retired cardiologist, and he said he couldn't offer services to anyone unless they quit smoking and quit eating trans fats. How do you feel, Dr. Ovadia, about addiction and heart health?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not willing to deny care to a patient because they are suffering from addiction, because that becomes a pretty slippery slope if we are going to be judging people on the decisions they make around their health. You know, my role as a physician is to offer that patient the best care that I can, the best education that I can, and hopefully that leads them, you know, to make good choices in their life. I know there are other cardiologists, other heart surgeons who, you know, will say the same thing. But that's not something I'm willing to do. I am, you know, I try my best to help every patient with where they are at. And, you know, right. We have to realize that smoking is addictive. Processed food is addictive. Yeah. So it's not as easy as saying, you know, just cut it out. And I'm not going to blame the patient if they can't. You know, if yep. they've tried and they just can't do that. So
One of the easiest things for a human being to do to another human being is to make a moral judgment. And as healthcare providers, I feel like our oath covers this. I don't think we get the liberty of making moral judgments about our patients. So if a patient comes to me as a smoker, I'm definitely going to tell them that's stupid and they need to stop that and it's very unhealthy, but never would I turn them away and not give them medical care because they have an addiction. But I think a lot of the older, especially the older doctors, they looked at this as a moral failing, not as an addiction. Now, Mark is a 59-year-old male diagnosed with AFib, but this is an electrical question that you may not want to field this one. Had a successful cardioversion in March, has got a normal sinus rhythm now, but the electrophysiologist insists he stays on Eliquis and propafenone indefinitely. Any thoughts or comments?
Yeah. So again, you know, similar to the decision around statins that we talked about earlier, you know, ask your physician, you know, what is the benefit of me taking this medication? What are the risks of me taking these medications? And what does indefinite mean? I mean, you know, to say that you need to be on a medication for the rest of your life implies that a deficiency in that medication is what is causing your problems. And usually You're that's right. not the case. Right. Usually there's some other root cause that has caused this issue. And if you can address that root cause, you know, hopefully you can reverse this condition and those medications become not necessary. But again, it's a nuanced discussion and you have to, you know, ask your physician and have that discussion. And if they're not willing to have that discussion with you, as we've said many times, seek out other physicians.
Yep. And let me tell all of our 4,400 viewers right now, your doctor absolutely believes in magic. Okay. They may deny that, but they believe in the magic of prescription pills and injections and infusions. They wouldn't say things like our previous questioner was told. And so many of us believe in the magic of grandma's chicken soup if we get sick, right? We don't know the science. We just believe it helps us feel better. When I grew up, if you had an upset stomach, you had to have ginger ale or 7-Up, something magical about that, right? Obviously, there's no magic there. That's dumb. But my grandparents believed that. And so that's what I always got. But people don't realize that doctors are just as susceptible to magical thinking. And also, some doctors are lazy. And so when they get you on a blood thinner and something for heart rhythm, even if your heart has completely healed, both electrically and physically, they're still going to just keep refilling that medication. And you have a duty to your health and to your family, because they depend on you, to ask the questions that Dr. Ovadia, my guest, who's a cardiothoracic surgeon, board certified, asked the question, why do I need this for the rest of my life? What's the research say? What's if I stop taking it, what's the odds ratio that something bad will happen? If I keep taking it, what percentage of protection does that give me? And again, if that doctor gets pissed off for you asking too many questions, huge red flag, you probably need to find another doctor. Anything to add to that, Dr. Ovadia?
Yeah, I would just add, you know, that we need to realize that there are very few medications that are truly life-saving. I actually would struggle to think of a situation where, you know, I could honestly say to the patient, if you don't take this medication, you know, you are going to die. And if you do take the medication, you know, you will live. It simply doesn't exist. There's no medication that is that powerful. But it's always everything we do in medicine, you know, honestly, everything we do in life is balancing the risks and the benefits. And you need to explore both sides of that equation to then make the informed decision about whether or not you want to take a medication, take a treatment. This applies to surgery as well. There are situations that I am having conversations with patients and, you know, we're in one of those situations where doing the heart surgery is clearly beneficial. Like no one can argue with it. We have the best data in the world. And yet the patient will sometimes say, I don't want the surgery for whatever reason. And it's not my job to force them to have the surgery. It's my job to educate them to say, this is what, you know, we know. But if you choose not to have the surgery, I'm still going to work with you to figure out, you know, what can we do to improve your life in this situation.
100% agree. Dr. Ovadia wrote a book. It's called Stay Off My Operating Table. This board certified cardiothoracic surgeon, as you can see from the picture of the foods on the front of his book, is a big believer in red meat and processed meat, just like I am. I don't think they're bad for you at all. I think all the research was equivocal at best. Whitney says, does aerobic exercise increase heart health, Dr. Ovadia?
So, you know, aerobic exercise, cardio, you know, as it's called, is actually fairly controversial. You know, when you look at we don't have great science. If you're looking at it from a purely weight loss perspective, we do have a good answer to that. And the answer is cardio does not help with weight loss. But that doesn't mean it's not beneficial. You know, there does seem to be benefits to your overall health, benefits to your heart from, you know, a moderate amount of cardio exercise, aerobic exercise. But, you know, like I said, if you're doing it strictly for weight loss, there is no benefit to cardio.
Totally agree.
I always encourage my patients to prioritize resistance exercise, building and maintaining muscle. Because again, we do have very good data that shows that the more that you are able to maintain muscle as you age, the longer you will live and the better quality of life you will have. So I always tell patients, prioritize the resistance exercise. If you want to do some cardio, if you want to do aerobic exercise after that, in addition to that, have at it. You know, it may help your health some, but again, don't count on it for weight loss purposes.
Yes, totally agree. Now, here's a question from Matt. I get this question every day, Doc, and I'm going to read the question, and I'm going to remind everybody who's about to answer this question, and I'm going to show your book while you answer this. My mother, Matt says, has had a TIA, a heart attack, and triple bypass. She has type 2 diabetes, but her heart surgeon says she cannot do keto. Can my mother do keto safely? Now, before you answer that, Doc, I want to remind everybody, all 4,700 people, this is a board-certified cardiothoracic surgeon, a heart surgeon. Listen to his answer, and I'm going to show you the book that he has written while he answers this question. Can Matt's mom do keto?
The answer is yes. And, you know, again, she should challenge her doctor to say, where is the evidence that I can't do a keto diet? You know, show me the study that shows it is harmful to heart patients.
Yep.
Because, you know, the evidence that we do have around keto, low carbohydrate diets in general, is that they improve type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is one of the biggest risk factors for heart disease. We also have studies that show benefits to ketogenic diets in the setting of heart failure. So these are people with low heart function and they go on ketogenic diets and or they take ketone supplements. The studies have been done with both ways. And there has been improvement in how they feel and their heart function. So I would challenge this heart surgeon to show me, to show your mother the evidence or show you the evidence that keto is dangerous for patients with heart disease.
And 100%.
The answer is the evidence doesn't exist.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of dietitians and cardiologists really need to shut the hell up about keto's dangerous. Keto's going to kill you, because basically they are saying something that there is not a shred of credible evidence to support. And when enough people hear interviews like this excellent interview with Dr. Philip Ovadia, they're going to start asking their cardiologist, well, you know what, doc, print me out the study that proves that. I know you're busy. I'll just have your nurse email it to me. She's got my email address. In a week or two, whenever you get around to it, doc, email me the study that shows causation between eating a ketogenic diet and worsening of AFib or CVD or CAD or any of the heart problems. I'll wait. And if I don't hear from you in a couple of weeks, doc, with the causative research, I'm going to find a new heart doctor. It's what I'm going to do. So I think a lot of heart doctors are going to start shutting the hell up about, oh, keto will kill your heart, if they don't have research to back it up, because patients are becoming increasingly educated and knowledgeable about this stuff. They can use PubMed.gov just like any other doctor can, and they can Google the big words they don't know. And before you know it, they've read all the existing literature on heart health, eating a high fat, low carb diet. And they're smarter than the cardiologist. Doc, we're at the bottom of the hour. I want you to tell everybody any final words, thoughts you have. Tell them about your book. Tell them where they can find you.
Yeah. So, you know, the final words of advice I have to each and everyone watching this is take back control of your health. You are in charge of your health. Your physician isn't in charge of it. The government isn't in charge of it. You know, the pharmaceutical, the food industries are not in charge of your health. You are in charge of your health, and you need to take back control of your health. For anyone that's interested in working with me, OvadiaHeartHealth.com, O-V-A-D-I-A, HeartHealth.com is my website, has all the information. You can find me mostly on Twitter at iFixHearts. I'm also on Instagram at OvadiaHeartHealth. But I love connecting with people. I love hearing from you. So, you know, my messages are always open on those platforms, and feel free to connect with me there.
I love it. Doc, thank you so very much for taking the time out of your schedule to do this. People absolutely have loved this chat. All you guys watching this, if you have a friend or loved one with heart disease, with high blood pressure, please consider sharing this video with them. Many people won't listen to their friends or family members, but if they hear a board certified heart surgeon saying this stuff, that may be just the last straw. They're like, okay, fine. If Dr. Ovadia says it's okay, I'm going to do it. And you could literally save someone's life by sharing this video. Dr. Ovadia, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for doing this. I've got all your links down in the show notes, including a link to the book. There is an Audible for people with ADHD like yours truly. Thank you, Doc, for doing this. Have a great evening.